This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Hello, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. You could make the case that here in Ireland, we should really be paying a lot more attention to current events in Poland. There's a few reasons for that. The Poles are Ireland's largest immigrant community, and there are also some interesting parallels between the historical experiences of our two countries. Recently, the war in Ukraine has tilted the EU's focus towards the concerns of its Central European member states, of which Poland is the largest, of course. And Poland has also been the scene of some dramatic political events over the past few months, which go to the heart of some of Europe's underlying contemporary politics. And finally, we should note that Poland's dramatic economic growth in recent years also contributes to what seems to be a rebalancing of European politics. So, for all of that, Derek Scally is our Berlin correspondent, but he also has a watching brief on events in Poland, and we're going to talk to him a little later about the political landscape in Germany. But first, Derek, I wanted to talk to you about some reports which you filed from Warsaw over the past while. You were there actually on a kind of a busman's holiday. You were launching the Polish edition of your excellent book, The Best Catholics in the World. Do Polish people see parallels between the Irish experience of Catholicism and the Polish one?
I think they do, with qualification. Obviously, both countries would consider themselves the best Catholics in the world. My book in Polish is actually called The Best Catholics Under the Sun. So those are fighting words. If you go to Poland, they would say they were very much the best Catholics in the world because they suffered the most. So there's a parallel, I think, there, the sort of suffering salvation narrative. Both countries oppressed, colonialized, and for many decades, centuries, Catholic identity was kind of like the vessel in which they could invest all their hope when the nation itself didn't exist. Poland obviously partitioned between Prussia and Russia and just had far more, in many cases, a far more tragic history than Ireland. So similar to Ireland, the priests were always there for the people. So I think that was always a sense that this is essential, an essential part of who we are. But of course, after the fall of communism, the Catholic Church in Poland rose to power just as it was starting to decline in Ireland. Obviously, Pope John Paul II, the Polish Pope, played a huge role in that. So its decline has been a bit delayed. I would say it's about 20 years behind the Irish decline, but they're having very similar debates over clerical sexual abuse, abuse of power, getting a little bit too involved in politics. And there's obviously the usual sort of prosperity and secularism go hand in hand, and the church is very much facing, standing on a precipice.
And what role does the church then play in day-to-day politics and in what I referred to at the outset, the sort of the turbulent events of the last while? You've had what's described as a national conservative party. The Law and Justice Party was in power for Poland for 8 years or so, and it lost in the most recent election to its centrist or liberal opponents. The Catholic Church presumably takes one side in that argument, or is that oversimplifying it?
No, I mean, not everyone in the Catholic Church, but pretty much the bishops in Poland very much took the side of the Law and Justice Party peace, where Law and Justice was very successful and very clever, and particularly in stirring up culture wars, things like LGBT rights and so on, or the LGBT ideology, as they would refer to it. And bishops very much jumped on that bandwagon, spoke of sort of an LGBT plague or virus, which was as bad as Bolshevism or Hitlerism, Nazism. So this was very strident language, and for many people, extremely hurtful, hateful even. And the trouble is that government is now out of power, and the Catholic Church is now standing there saying, oh, right, okay, what do we do now? But people really, many people won't forgive and won't forget.
So Law and Justice in its 8 years in power is really attempted, I think it's fair to say, to remake the institutions of Polish society, the judiciary, the media, other areas of life as well, which drew a lot of criticism from outside, particularly from Brussels and from the EU. And it was often in conflict with the EU over those. And what we've seen now over the last few months is an attempt to reverse those changes.
Yes, they very much said they had a mandate to complete the transition from communism to democracy. Unlike other countries, Poland didn't make a clean break. There was sort of a slight cohabitation. There was a slight overlapping with the communist period. And Jarosław Kaczyński, one of two twin brothers who founded Law and Justice, they said, we replace one rotten elite with another rotten elite. And there was just a little bit too much, sort of in Ireland, you'd sort of call it a Dublin Four dinner party circuit running the country. And they said, we need to clear this up. We need to do a purge of the judiciary. We need to clean up public media and reflect the full Poland, not just sort of the liberal urban elite. The trouble with that was everything they did seemed to, it looked like what they were doing is just replacing one elite with their own. They're creating a new elite of party loyalists. So critics at home in Poland, but also in Brussels, said you're putting party loyalists into positions where they're not qualified in the judiciary, in public media, and the only price for that is you have to be loyal to peace. So they were very much going down an Orban line, many people would say. They were trying to create an entire state beholden to a political party, a political movement. And the rule of law is very much at odds with that. It should be opposed to any politicians. Politicians come and go, but the laws stay, and you need a judiciary that is a guardian of the law and not pals of the ruling party. So by the end, after 8 years, most voters seem to see, well, actually their promises were not really what they promised. The judicial system is tied up in knots, and it takes longer rather than shorter to get things through the courts, which is what they promised. Public television is a joke, and even people in the countryside who would have been traditionally peace supporters were very much disillusioned, partly because a lot of EU funding, pandemic funding, billions and billions of money was being held up because increasingly it was seen that peace was a problem for all of Poland.
So just to tease out the first part of that before we come to what the consequences were and where we are now, I mean, to what extent was the criticism of the liberal elite justified? It clearly had enough potency to get law and justice elected. I mean, I've read various writers, liberal writers, the American writer Anne Applebaum, for example, who I think lives in Poland at least part of every year and is very embedded in Polish politics. She partly describes this as a sort of contestation of elites, an attempt to take by one elite, possibly, to take power back from another. But they wouldn't be able to do that if there wasn't some real sense of justification. And the other part of this, of course, is that you mentioned Viktor Orban, and both his government and the Kaczynski government were both sort of held up as reactionary models for taking back the heights of the knowledge economy, academia, the judiciary, the media, from the liberal elite who controlled them. Obviously, that had a resonance and worked at least for a while in Poland.
Yes, I mean, there's always an accusation, sort of a liberal arrogance that sort of, or the intolerant of the tolerant. So they very much played that, and they said, these people in Warsaw are playing you for fools. They look down on you. They think you're stupid. They don't think you're capable of anything. They've left you behind, and they've taken care of their own. It's if you're living sort of outside of some of the major Polish cities, it really resonates because many of them do feel left behind. If you go and visit their towns, you know, it's another Poland. It's a very different Poland, particularly in the eastern Poland over towards Belarus and Ukraine. So, the sort of the resentment narrative or the victim narrative, it struck a chord with them. But in part, in some cases, I think it was justified. I mean, if you look at the first Donald Tusk government, so before he went to Brussels to become European Council President, he was Prime Minister. And there really was a sort of a sense of we know best. And I think perhaps rightly they were deposed because they really had lost touch. And there was sort of a we know best tone to a lot of their communication. Many people are now saying, well, Donald Tusk is back in. He seems to have learned his lesson. But his government, some of the critics are saying already, and they only came into power in December, that there's still this sort of we know best, we know what's good for you. And that may once again come back to haunt them.
So there is a kind of conundrum facing the Tusk government, isn't there? If we take it on its own words, it wants to restore the kind of the values of a constitutional liberal democracy, which you mentioned earlier. But 8 years of law and justice has embedded, you know, a certain type of judge and in the judiciary. The president has constitutional rights to block certain types of legislation. There are other parts of civil society, particularly public service media, for example, which became an extraordinary kind of propaganda tool of the previous governing party. And in order to reverse all of those and to return to liberal democratic values, one perhaps has to act in a illiberal or undemocratic way.
Well, the question is, does Poland want to return to liberal democracy? I mean, Poland, Law and Justice was proposing something far away from liberal democracy. It was an authoritarian democracy. And I spoke to one think tank guy in Warsaw, and he said basically what we had is one revolutionary movement, which is now an opposition piece, and a counter-revolutionary movement in government. And each side refers to the other as evil, absolute evil. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with. It sort of sounds like Lord of the Rings or something. It's a, the polarization is absolutely complete. It's comparable, really, to the US, where reason is not always necessary in this debate. Conviction that you are right is what you need to get ahead in Polish politics sometimes. And it's very difficult because one side, the current government says it's playing by the rules. The previous government said, no, we'll remake those rules. Those rules and the judges of those rules were all corrupt. So, I think to defend the Tusk government, they really do seem they're in line with what the European Union wants. Now, of course, peace would say, well, we need to change the European Union. That's the problem too. So it's, yeah, how do you undo it? And how do you stay within the rules? How do you unbreak rules that were broken without yourself breaking the rules? And you're dealing with politicians in Warsaw. I mean, Donald Tusk, he said, I'm interested in good politics, and good politics, he said, I'm quoting him here, cannot be about finding a compromise between lies and truth, lawlessness and law. So, but for many opponents of Tusk, and there are many opponents of Tusk, that sounds again like, I know best, we know best, trust us. And many people won't buy that. But I think most Poles are prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt for a while.
Can I ask you about the television station and public service media? I mean, obviously I don't speak Polish, but I've seen some samples, translated samples of what was going on. I think for people in many other countries, including in Ireland, the idea that the public service broadcaster was so absolutely not just in the tank for the governing party during an election campaign, but really, you know, published, you know, smears and libels against Tusk and other opposition figures in a way that I think we associate with the worst kind of, you know, marginal propagandistic media in this part of the world. How did that happen? Was it the case that public service media had never been properly independent from governments previously, or was that a kind of a sea change?
No, I think public broadcasting in Poland is very different to what we would consider public broadcasting, or let's say the BBC as the high watermark. It's always been a bit of a political football. So no party in Poland is innocent of influence on public media. But I think PiS took things to a new extreme. They appointed their own people, and there was this sudden shift of narrative, probably about 2016, after PiS took office. And there was sort of a, I would almost call it a Joseph Goebbels playbook, where you just take lies and you repeat them, and you take fear and you repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it. And eventually people believe it, or their viewers believe it. So they would talk of invasions, of migrants, of the dangers of LGBT ideology. They would claim Tusk was a German agent preparing to sell out his homeland to Berlin. They harassed people. They smeared people, as you said. It just got to an extreme that nobody really was watching it anymore. Nobody took it seriously. But if you were in that world, it's sort of like Fox News on drugs. That's what you believed. And tackling that, many people have said the government, the Tusk government now, has actually bent, or if not broken, the law to get it back on some sort of an even keel. But many people would say, yeah, is an even keel your even keel, or is it an even keel where it's representative of all views in Poland?
Because there are other media in Poland, and quite a lot of them are foreign owned.
Yes, there are, but I was in TVP, which is public television, a few months ago. I visited the headquarters. It was surrounded by police to stop what they thought would be, you know, attacks from the opposition, the former government. And I talked to the editor-in-chief of the main news program, and he said for 8 years we had propaganda and hate speech, which led to suicides and other terrible things. He told me, now we want to give people a voice, not tell them what to think. And that wasn't possible in the last 8 years. I also met people who used to be part of TVP who were ousted. And I asked them that question. I said, you claim TVP is now back in the hands of the hated liberal elite. Why haven't you set up your own broadcaster? Because many of the private broadcasters are considered, let's say, centre-left, centre-liberal. And these TVP people, yeah, they just threw their hands up in the air and they said, yeah, we should have set up our own right-wing sort of Fox News or GB News or something. And they haven't. So it's all very well for them to complain that TVP is now another part of the liberal elite project. but they haven't really set up anything themselves.
When these kind of debates happen in other countries, including the United States and in Hungary and other European countries, one of the things that comes up is, what is the strength of the institutions, the civic institutions, the legal system, an independent media, intellectual life, those kinds of areas? And one of the huge differences, I suppose, between Poland and Ireland is that Poland experienced an absolutely appalling 20th century of total war, two world wars, the Holocaust largely carried out on its territory, Nazism followed by a communist totalitarian and a Soviet occupation. So the question, I suppose, arises, how strong are one's institutions after all that if they were only really kind of reinvigorated or brought back to life only a little bit over 30 years ago?
Yes, this is the question. I was in Warsaw last week and I spoke to the Justice Minister, Adam Bodnar, about this very question. And he would be critical of this view that sort of, oh, Poland is a young democracy and they don't quite understand the rule of law and how things work. And he would basically said, yes, it's true. Things got out of hand. It was very easy for one political party to capture the institutions. But he said, you know, are your institutions any safer? Do you know? Are you just assuming because democracy has deep roots in your country that something similar can't happen? I mean, there are people in Germany who are literally, they're almost hacking the institutions to see how easy would it be for an extremist party to break in. And they found many loopholes. And I'd say in Ireland, it's no different. So we need to be careful that old Poland is sort of, they don't understand things. They're just a little bit behind the curve. I don't think anyone has actually checked how easy it would be to take over judicial appointments or alter the procedure so that you get your judges in. And I asked him, so what is the lesson then? He said, well, Poland is not necessarily the past. Poland could be your future very soon if you don't watch out. And he very much said, you know, we shouldn't be taking for granted the freedom that democracy and democratic institutions offer. And we should acknowledge that many citizens actually don't understand the role of these democratic institutions, and particularly the judiciary. We have this idea that the judiciary should be kept separate. We shouldn't talk too much with them. Their judgments must stand for themselves. But if people don't understand why judges are there, a political party that comes along and says, oh, these judges, they're just an elite. The people, the voice of the people, we represent that. You can have a takeover quite quickly, like in Poland. And I asked him, Adam Bodnar, the justice minister in Poland, so what should we do? And he said, we need to really invest and more in relations between, let's say, the courts and the citizens. Don't leave the courts alone. Encourage them to explain what they do. Encourage NGOs to explain the role of the democratic institutions. And I think really, rather than sort of looking over a shoulder and saying those poor Poles, eventually they'll learn, I think we should actually look at ourselves and say, are we really so secure? Because, you know, we have lived in Ireland with sort of a cultural exceptionalism for decades, thinking we're different. We're not different. And I think our institutions are probably as vulnerable as they are in Poland.
I think I certainly wasn't suggesting that Poland was somehow underdeveloped. It's a very sophisticated country and society and culture in many ways. And in fact, one of the things I think about, one of the misconceptions I think from the Western fringes of Europe where I am right now, is that Poland is an Eastern European country. It's very much a part of Central Europe, of Middle Europa, with all the cultural, political, and philosophical traditions that implies, which does make me wonder why the culture war, as you say, is quite as vicious there. What are the forces? I mean, I mentioned at the outset that it's been a location for rapid economic change and economic growth over the last 30 years. Is that a contributing factor?
I think Poland is just going through, I think, what Ireland experienced in the post-war period, or let's say from the 1980s on. It's experiencing it in warp speed. So Ireland's development has been very quick. I mean, it caught up with Western Europe quite quickly after joining the EEC, as it was at the time, in 1973. Well, Poland joined the EU 20 years ago, and I think it's almost doubled its the progress. It's catching up economically with countries like Spain. I think it's overtaken Portugal by certain measures. It's just a remarkable country. It's a beautiful place, and I think we in Western Europe, we almost need to sort of set aside the communist goggles that we always use to look at Poland. You know, Poland is not this grey place. Warsaw is a beautifully green city. It had one of, I think it had the first constitution in Europe centuries and centuries ago. So it had its own empire. And I think there's always a sort of a, but despite all this, there is a considerable inferiority complex that they aren't taken seriously, that they need to be, attention must be paid, you know, like death of a salesman. And they're just catching up. A lot has happened in a very brief period of time. And I think there's still a lot to play for in Poland in a way that perhaps other countries where things have settled down a bit more. And so they are being played for. And of course, they're connected into these culture wars. And I would say really that Poland is really more a taste of things to come rather than a look in the rearview mirror.
And this is not a static situation. This is changing all the time alongside the economic growth. And, you know, let's not forget that Poland is a large country. It's one of the EU's largest countries. There's a war on its borders. And that, again, has changed the balance of debate and the dynamic within the European Union and within NATO, of which Poland is a member as well. What impact does that have on the internal politics of Poland?
Well, I think you're seeing Poland moving up, stepping up. I mean, since Donald Tusk has come back, many people in Poland say, wow, you really noticed the change of his time in Brussels. He really knows how to represent Poland in a way that isn't embarrassing to them. He knows how to speak the language of international diplomacy. And in Radoslaw Sikorski, his foreign minister, who's married to Anne Applebaum, who you mentioned, he's very much also an international player. So Poles no longer feel as embarrassed as they would have in the last 8 years, perhaps, by some of their politicians. And I think with Ukraine, I mean, many people, I think the one thing that Donald Tusk and Kaczynski, Jarosław Kaczynski, the leader of peace, his nemesis, I think there was really only one issue on which they agreed, which was beware of Russia. And countries like Germany weren't listening to their warnings. So now I think they're not tooting their own horn, but they're saying, I think you should continue to listen to us now in a way that you didn't in the past. And on Ukraine in particular, they've really shown tremendous leadership. I mean, I think in relative terms, Poland is perhaps the greatest contributor of aid, assistance, and certainly taking in people. And I've just noticed, you know, in trio appearances of Tusk and Macron from France and Scholz from Germany, Tusk really, he is showing a sort of a style of leadership, which I think people are sitting up and taking notice of now. And so I think there's a huge trust invested in Poland, and perhaps there hasn't been in the last while. And it'd be nice to think that that will filter down international politics, that Poland is back, Poland is being taken seriously. So maybe we should get over ourselves and our inferiority complexes or our neuroses and realise that we are taken seriously and we are respected.
That's good to hear. It's the last question on Poland then. If Poland is a picture of the European future, is it a picture that we could be optimistic about?
I think so, but I think it's all about communication. I mean, a government in the capital who says we're doing this because we know it's right and don't take the time to explain to people far from the capital. I mean, this is a pattern we see all over Europe. You could say that's what was laid behind Brexit. You could say that's what lies behind any of Ireland's referenda that go wrong. So I think Poland is a very chastening example for all European politicians, that if you get lazy or if you get arrogant and if you don't explain things to your voters, why should voters vote for you? And I think it's really a case of getting back to basics. And you ignore women and you attack minorities at your cost, because the last government did all of that. They imposed a de facto abortion ban. They described LGBT as a plague. While it seems like there are quick votes to be had with populist politics, it will catch up with you as well.
We're going to take a quick break, but before we do, just to remind our listeners that Derek is our Berlin correspondent and reports from elsewhere, that the Irish Times has a range of international correspondents around the world, including in London, in Washington, in Beijing and in Brussels and elsewhere, and that these things actually cost money, and we're the only Irish media organisation that has as extensive a network of foreign correspondents. It's something we pride ourselves on and it's something we're committed to, but it does cost money. And if you appreciate the fact that we're giving you an Irish perspective on events around the world, we would be very grateful if you don't already, that you might consider becoming a subscriber to the Irish Times. Just go to irishtimes.com/subscribe. We'll be back after this break to discuss Germany with Derek.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back to the podcast. Derek Scally is still here with me. Derek, we are moving west across the border into Germany, your regular beat. Germany from here looks sort of down and depressed at the moment. Is that inaccurate?
Oh, definitely. There's no country in Europe that's able to self-flagellate like the Germans. I often think of Martin Luther, the Reformation, the man who started the Reformation, sort of beating himself up in his chamber at night. And I sometimes think Germany hasn't really come too far from that. Things are bad, but there's no one like the Germans to make it feel worse.
How bad are they economically?
Well, the country's in recession. There's some talk this week that things are turning a corner, but they've been turning a corner now for quite some time. It's an export-led economy, and nobody's buying what Germany's selling at the moment. We have, you know, people like Elon Musk at the portals of Berlin, just outside Berlin, with his Tesla factory, stealing a march on the German car giants. And it really is symbolic, I think, of what there was a certain amount of complacency, I think, in the German industrial model, whether it was energy from Russia or exports to China. Olaf Scholz was in China basically saying, please buy our stuff. And we'll see how that works out. But yeah, it's a time of change. I think the pandemic shook a lot of people up, but then the war in Ukraine has obviously hit Germany particularly hard. It feels an obligation to assist, and it is assisting, but at a huge cost, at least 100 billion for its own military to step up its defences. So I think we're in a position of change. People talk about the sick man of Europe. The Economist kind of goes from talking about sick man of Europe to Germany wants to rule Europe to sick man of Europe. That's their cycle. So they're very much on a sick man of Europe part of the cycle. And people here are depressed. But yeah, it's just a lot to get through. The question is this the government that will get the country through?
And do they feel that, I take your point about the kind of German existentialism, but do they feel that this is a temporary blip in the wake of the war in Ukraine, COVID, various other things? Or is there a sense that the German economic model, which has certainly, you know, come in for much praise over the years and has been compared favourably with other economic models, that it really needs a serious retooling at this point in terms of the challenge from China, the challenge to the automotive industry, maybe the implications of a new global energy order and what that might mean for things like the chemical industries?
That's it. I mean, I think when we look back on this era, sort of the post-COVID era, it was kind of where the tide went out and a lot of weaknesses were exposed in a lot of countries, including in Germany. They were already in the middle of sort of this massive shift to green energy, which is continuing, but Russia and Russia's invasion of Ukraine sort of pulled the plug on, or it just crashed a lot of what it was trying to do. And it's still pushing ahead with climate protection measures and green energy. So it really, in many ways, in hindsight, we may look back and say that despite it all, Germany actually got ahead of the rest of Europe with green energy, or it made a mess of it. We don't know how this bet is going to pay off. So we're in the middle of something. I think, yeah, the question is Germany's dependence on production is slightly problematic, because something like the automotive industry, in 50 years' time, do we know Germany will have an automotive industry, or will China have swallowed that? I mean, this government came to power in December 2021, promising to sort of square the circle. It's three parties, Social Democrats, so centre-left, Greens, also centre-left, and the Free Democrats, who are liberals, so they're very much on the right of the political spectrum. And they still said that they could square that circle of not being really speaking in the same political language. And they said it was going to be a government of green transformation and innovation, so that Germany could have a second industrial revolution, that Germany could make the machines that would make, that companies would be buying for their new green, climate-friendly product. So we're not quite there yet, and I'm not sure if we will get there, but this government has really, this project has almost been forgotten because of the war in Ukraine and other risks, the war in Israel-Gaza for another. So it's a government it was always going to be a bit of a struggle to make things work, but now they're really not really working or talking.
Yeah, looking at it from abroad, it does seem to be stalled. Those differences, some of those profound differences seem to be irreconcilable between the three parties. And there's a further element, isn't it, which are these fiscal constraints which exist at the constitutional level in Germany, so that some of the economic triggers which other countries might use when faced with recession are not necessarily open to Germany.
Exactly. I mean, people forget back when Germany and other European countries were forcing austerity, as many Irish people saw it, down their throats. They were actually imposing similar conditions on themselves with the so-called debt brake limiting the amount of borrowing you can do and linking it to economic growth. So no economic growth, no borrowing. And this was set aside during the pandemic, but the new Liberal finance minister, Christian Lindner, he very much wants to get back to this. He wants to get away from the exception era of the pandemic. So he's saying austerity is back. We need to cut our way back to growth. We need to sort of cut away the fat, make the state leaner, allow even for tax cuts. And then we have two other parties, the Social Democrats and the Greens, saying, oh God, no, we need to invest. We need to invest. So you're sort of seeing the euro crisis playing out again here. You know, should you spend or save your way back to growth? And then you have, you know, things, external factors like the Constitutional Court. Last year it threw out the government's budget because it said the accounting was just a little bit too creative. So the red pen came out for this year's budget. There's even more red pen for next year's budget. So Germany is in a recession and has a finance minister that believes we can cut our way back to health.
I mean, this does have strange echoes of events of 10 years or more ago and of the austerity measures imposed at Germany's behest across the EU. And, you know, a strong critique of that at the time was that it benefited Germany and didn't benefit the countries who suffered most, among them Ireland at one stage.
Yes, but now Germany is doing it to itself, which is absolutely fascinating. And I mean, there are a lot of loud voices saying we need to reform this debt brake. It's a primitive tool. We need to make exceptions for deficit spending on, let's say, infrastructure, because that will benefit future generations. You know, spending money on good roads or upgrading Germany's increasingly decrepit rail system. You know, this isn't pre-election giveaways to politicians, to their constituents. This is sensible spending. So, but it's remarkable. It's, trying to say that to people, to even the finance minister, you know, he's not interested in hearing that. And many people agree with him. I mean, it's staggering, really. On the one hand. On the other hand, there is a huge, I mean, public support for this debt brake is quite strong because they believe politicians don't always act well or don't always have, let's say, long-term goals in mind in terms of spending, and they actually mistrust their politicians to such an extent that many Germans would prefer this debt brake so that they don't basically just try to bribe people with their own money and try to create a state which is just extremely flabby with deficit spending. So it is interesting that many Germans actually mistrust their politicians to such an extent they would rather have this debt brake in place.
My incredibly simplistic understanding of that is it has something deep-rooted cultural in German 20th century history. It has something to do with wheelbarrows of Reichsmarks being, trundled down to banks to pay for, a pound of butter in 1926 or whatever it is. That this German obsession with fiscal probity kind of goes back to that and that it's still there?
Yes, I mean, from many Germans' perspective, their medicine for the euro crisis countries like Ireland was correct, that they didn't necessarily see the huge social costs, but Ireland did bounce back in their view. So their recipes perhaps were right from their view. And yes, things like hyperinflation sit deep. I mean, when inflation really rose after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I mean, there was huge hand-wringing here. It is going down, but it does touch buttons. And I think you may not agree with German economic policy, but every country has the buttons. And when those buttons are pushed, things are not necessarily as rational as you might think elsewhere. But I think looking forward, Germany, many Germans and certainly the German finance ministers, look, this is an aging country. We're going through a huge period of change. If we keep borrowing money, do you think the markets are going to just keep doing it? Or will they eventually say, hang on, what will Germany be in 30 years? Can we really just give away money to this country? Until now, Germany's always been seen as a safe bet. yet. But as we've been discussing, it's going through convulsions about what kind of an industrial power it will be in the future, the near future. So the finance minister would say, well, just taking endless amounts of debt will could be our undoing if markets start to take fright or have doubts about, is Germany a safe bet?
One of the things about German politics is there always seems to be an election on the horizon because of the federal nature of its political system. So there's always some significant contest in the offing. And of course, we also have European elections due in early June. The state of the parties, the most notable thing seems to be the rise of the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland.
Yes, I mean, there's three federal states in eastern Germany who have elections coming up in September. And in all three of them, the AfD is leading the polls, which creates huge headaches and panic among the other parties. You know, the AfD has been around for 10 years. It started as a Euro skeptic, you know, opposed to bailouts party, and it's now pivoted quite cleanly to a classic right-wing populist, anti-immigrant, anti-woke party. And but they're soaring in these eastern states, and nobody's quite sure what will happen after those elections. It's slightly different at federal level. I mean, the CDU of Angela Merkel, now in opposition, is, you know, reigning supreme on 30-31%, and the SPD, the Olaf Scholz's ruling party, literally half that on 16%. So they finished the election in 2021 almost neck and neck, 24 and 25% respectively. So, you know, the SPD is down 10 points. So it's if there was a federal election this year, it'll be next year. But if there was a federal election this year, we definitely see a return to, I think, Merkel's party, possibly with the Greens.
Although there is a debate across several European countries at the moment, isn't there, among centre-right parties about how best to deal with the threat from their right flank, which in the case of Germany comes from the AfD. And in some cases, those parties are either looking to outflank their further right competitors, and in others, they're looking to ally with them, as they did in the recent, unsuccessfully, it should be said, in the recent Spanish elections. Is it because of German history or because of the nature of the AfD that those ideas remain outside the pale in Germany?
Well, the question is, are they outside the pale? I mean, many people would argue that the AfD has succeeded, as many other similar parties in Europe have succeeded, in shifting the narrative sort of to the centre, or even more to the right. So what is sayable, what is unsayable? You see, I think Sweden is a very good example, where the Sweden Democrats have basically were saying things 10 years ago that the ruling Conservatives are saying now about, let's say, immigration. And in Germany, you're starting to see that as well. I mean, the CDU is trying to come up with a new party program, and I saw a draft of it in which the draft said Muslims who share German values are welcome here. And this caused huge upset, because they said, why are you focusing, among, let's say, the German Muslim community, why are you focusing, targeting Muslims? And then they changed the language to, an Islam that does not reflect German values is not welcome in Germany. So, I mean, they're trying out dog whistles here, it seems. I think the AfD is changing and will continue to change German politics. But you could say, perhaps it's not a perfect example, but similar to Poland, that they spotted an electorate, they spotted views, and they just spotted this open flank that Angela Merkel left on the right wing of German politics. And she had done the thing you must never do, according to her mentor, Helmut Kohl. You must never allow a party to rise to the right of the CDU. But she did, and it rose. And they just filled a gap in the market, and they're exploiting it quite cleverly.
The other thing that seems to be changing, or seems to be in the process of being remade, is traditional German foreign policy. The invasion in Ukraine led to a very different kind of a German voice on Germany's responsibility for European security, significant debate and a commitment to, you know, to military spending, which hadn't been there previously. Is that still in flux, or is that, have we arrived now at the new German foreign policy, or is that still changing?
No, it's very much still in flux, both on Russia and on Israel. I mean, Donald Tusk was in Berlin a few weeks ago, and I smiled when he said something. He said, you know, we hope certain countries, he didn't say which country he meant, but everyone knew he was talking about Germany. We hope in Poland that certain countries are no longer basing geopolitical decisions on wishful thinking. And I think you can see definitely in Russia, there was a huge amount of wishful thinking. The idea that if you create huge business ties, which are just happen to be very profitable for German businesses with Russia, and that somehow it will be impossible for Russia to go rogue. And they were warned by the Baltic countries and by Poland and by Ukraine that this is not good, that Putin can't be trusted, but Germany knew best. And there was a huge amount of wishful thinking, you could say a little bit of war guilt thrown in for good measure. And they had a very much a rude awakening. And many people in leading positions in German politics will say, yes, we got that wrong. When you actually ask them, why did you get it wrong? You don't really get a coherent answer, which I think is quite interesting. But yeah, on Russia, Germany has very much broken with Moscow, and I don't really see how things can come back. Interestingly, the extremist parties, the far right, AfD, and a new party around a leftist politician, Sarah Wagenknecht, they're both saying, coming out with a very strong, we need to negotiate with Russia. This war is just a madness for all sides. It's only good for the German arms industry and so on. And that has huge play, particularly in eastern states. So German-Russian policy is very much in flux at the moment.
And the other part of that, of course, is a huge amount of debate in European countries, European members of NATO in particular, about a generally perceived drifting away from the United States to commitment to the defence of Western and Central Europe, and what that might mean for that military alliance into the future. And obviously this is kind of central, not just to Germany, but even more so perhaps to Poland. Are there debates of that sort taking place in Germany? Because it strikes me that if there is to be a more coherent approach to the defence of European democracies, Germany is the largest and most powerful country, needs to be at the centre of it, or it's not going to work.
Oh, precisely. I mean, there's so much tragedy has arisen from the ongoing war in Ukraine. I think one, I hesitate to call it positive effect, but it has shaken Germany awake and realized that for the last 20 years, 30 years, in the post-unification period, they just kind of let defense slide. And even Merkel, she cut back the military to ridiculous degrees, that Germany at the present isn't able to defend itself, particularly not now that it's given so much of its equipment, military equipment, to Ukraine. So Olaf Scholz, he gave this speech shortly after the Ukraine invasion by Russia and said, you know, this is a Zeitenwende, this is a watershed. We are going to invest 100 billion over the next few years to bring German defense up to speed. And this year, he said, we will meet NATO commitments of 3% of GDP spent on defense. So there's been a huge shift here, and Germany would always, you know, the lessons of the Second World War, pacifism and so on. But many people are now saying, well, it's all right to be pacifist, but if you're actually unable to defend yourself, that's a very strange kind of pacifism. I would say there are certain parallels to the Irish debate, but there's definitely a shift underway here. It'll be interesting once we get to, let's say, recruitment again. They abolished compulsory military service in Germany. They're debating now how to bring that back, what model would work best. And that's a huge challenge in many countries.
You mentioned Israel and Gaza, and maybe this will be a last question to you, Derek. I mean, I think Germany and Ireland are nearly as far apart as fellow members of the EU could be. I think, you know, huge negative reaction to Ursula von der Leyen's position on the conflict, tensions within Germany about, you know, what approach the country should take. It has traditionally adopted an extremely pro-Israel policy, I think it's fair to say. Is that changing in any way, or are those tensions becoming more pronounced?
Yeah, it's a huge moral, political, geopolitical dilemma for Germany because of the Shoah, the Holocaust. They do have a moral responsibility for the country and its continued existence. Angela Merkel, I think, Yeah, she left quite a legacy because she came up with this idea of Staatsräson, that Israel's continued existence is a reason of state for Germany. But nobody quite knows what that means. Does this mean Germany will go to war for Israel, or is it just more sort of a political term rather than a legal term? And it's a huge problem for Germany because on the one hand, they've lashed themselves to the Israeli state and defending that Israeli state. But the problem with this logic is that are they also bound to whatever government Israelis elect, including the pre-war extremist Netanyahu government? And this is a contradiction, I think, at the heart of German politics. And rather than really confronting that dilemma, are you standing for the state or are you standing for extremist Israeli policy? Are you defending that? You see German politicians are starting to back away, very much like the US. But like the US, they cannot just break ties. People would say here, well, it's very easy to Ireland to have the views it has because there's no social cost. And while many Irish people feel they are completely morally in the right, and I think many people would agree with them on what's happening in Gaza, it's just not that simple for Germans. So, and many people would rather ignore the contradictions at the heart of their own approach to Israel. And so they're attacking lots of critics of Israel, people saying things very similar to what you would hear in Ireland, and accusing them of being anti-Semites or encouraging state bodies to withdraw their funding. So there's something of a witch hunt going on here, which I think really needs to be addressed quickly. Because when you ask these people who shout, like the boy who cried wolf, the boy who cried anti-Semite, when you ask them, so what did this person who enrages you so much say that was actually anti-Semitic? Things go quiet again. So it's a very troubling time here. I've spoken with many people. I've done many interviews with people over the last months who really say Germany needs to grow up here. It needs to have a sort of a more independent attitude towards Israel and not feel morally beholden to any government that comes along. So again, like everything we've been talking about on Germany in this podcast, it's a period of extreme transition that Germany didn't see coming. And yeah, it really wasn't prepared, whether on Russia, whether on Israel, whether on, you know, its new economic model. So it's certainly an interesting time to be here as a foreign correspondent.
It certainly is. Derek, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you at the wrap of the week later on in the week on Friday. We'll look forward to seeing you then.